Welcome to Deep Dive Space Tech, from space access to Earth applications. Your business, investment, and technology podcast by DWR Eco in cooperation with Mission Homebound and hosted by David Wortman.
I'm very happy to meet Gopika Suresh. She is Chief Strategy Officer of Marble Imaging. She's also co-founder of that company. Hi, how are you?
Hi, David. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me. It's a beautiful, warm, sunny day in Frankfurt, so I'm doing quite well. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Well, this is always good to hear. I'm in Berlin. Very nice the weather here as well. Let's just jump right into the topic. So you are a space tech company. What are you guys doing? Maybe one sentence.
It's all rocket science, David.
It's all rocket
science,
yes.
That's exactly what we're doing. It's all rocket science. Marble Imaging is 3 years old, and we are developing Europe's first constellation of multispectral satellites that can provide global imaging of the planet in very high resolution. I can break this down. Basically, when you don't have the images on Google Earth, for example, you are blind to a lot of things. You are very used to seeing satellite imagery all over the place. So Marble Imaging is making sure that we give you the information so that you can make decisions rapidly. And currently, there is no European provider for giving this information on a daily revisit rate in very high resolution. So Marble Imaging is going to be the first.
Great. This is, I think, the key word here, to be the first. Why are you the first? Because we have a lot of imaging already on our iPhones. Professionals are using this as well. Is this just totally US dominated? Maybe you could break this down for us, where the images are coming from right now.
Sure. We're the first because currently in Europe, the only other providers of imagery in the very high resolution domain, so that means below 1 meter, is Airbus. But they do not have the capability to provide you daily imaging of the entire planet. What you see on Google Maps or on Google Earth are all coming from non-European American providers. And what's happening right now in the current geopolitical situation is that a lot of the non-European providers have stopped providing imagery to European customers, which means that there is no data. And that's why we will be the first ones in Europe to provide this kind of imagery. And we are a European company.
Europe has programs like Copernicus and Galileo. So what are these satellites doing? What you really are now doing better?
It's a very good question. I've worked with Copernicus data. So I've been working with satellite imagery for the last 16 years, and I'm the biggest fan of Copernicus and the Sentinels. Unfortunately, the resolution of the Sentinels is what we call medium resolution. So it's above 10 meter resolution. And this is not sufficient for a lot of applications that require detailed imagery. So this means that in 10 meter resolution, the more you zoom in, the more pixelated or the more foggy the pixels get. And very high resolution imagery can be used for critical infrastructure monitoring, can be used also for, in the climate tech world, for plantations mapping, things like that.
Yes, and let's talk about that a little later. Before we do this, why aren't they able to do this to a 1 meter solution resolution, how you do this? Is it because of the technology they're using? Is it because of the way how they are flying, the height, etc.? So what is the main difference here in terms of technology and maybe flight pattern?
It's a very good question. The Copernicus mission was mainly for providing an alternative to the USGS Landsat data from Europe. That means they have very wide swaths. They cover a large area. And this also means that the pixels are a lot bigger than the very high resolution satellites. What is good about the Copernicus mission is that we have data since 2016 in different kinds of satellites and different kinds of spectral domains. However, it is very difficult to really get detailed information from them, as I said, right? The reason why they're not stepping into the very high domain right now, the very high resolution domain right now, is because they are catering really to large scale mapping, versus very high resolution satellites have a much smaller swath, which means we will not be able to cover the entire globe in one day with one satellite, which is why you need to think about constellations as we are thinking.
This is not about the lenses you're using. This is more about how you fly and how and where you fly?
Yes and no. So it is a lot about the optics. To get very high resolution, you need to have a larger focal length. So you need the optics to support it. And so it is about the optics, but also about the height. The Copernicus satellites are currently flying between 700, 800 kilometer altitudes. They're very big satellites. They are, I don't know the exact sizes, but they're much, much larger than what we are attempting to fly. So as a reference, our satellites are about 150 kilograms to about 200 kilograms. They are the size of a washing machine. And they will be flying at altitudes between 450 to 600 kilometers. This has an impact on the resolution, but the optics also has an impact on the resolution. And it's also a fine trade-off between the optics, the quality of the images, the orbital height. It all plays together.
Okay, so, but Copernicus, just coming back to this reference, because some people may know this program, is actually able to cover nearly 100% of the Earth surface, right? But you guys would focus on certain areas. Where are you making your decisions? Or is it just a matter of scale in terms of numbers of satellites you bring into the orbit so that down the road you can also cover all of Earth's surface?
Copernicus can cover the entire globe, but over a period of, I think, I'm not sure about the number here, so, but it takes a long time. So we say the repeat cycle of one Copernicus Sentinel-2 satellite, for example, is 11 days, which means it comes back to the same spot every 11 days. And to cover the entire...
I think what I heard, maybe I might be wrong as well, but I thought it was like 5 days, but this is still a long time, right? Compared...
This is with two satellites. 5 to 6 days is with two satellites.
All right, maybe, okay,
good. You're absolutely correct.
Yes, yes.
There are, in the Sentinel-2 missions, there are currently two satellites, three, if you also take the first satellite, which is due for decommissioning.
Yes.
But they cannot do daily global coverage, so they cannot cover the entire globe in one day. This is what we can do with a constellation of 20 satellites. We can cover the entire globe in one day. And we can come back to the same spot, at least over Europe with 5 satellites. We plan to have daily coverage over Europe, and with 20 satellites, daily coverage over the entire globe.
Okay. So daily coverage means every 24 hours you can update the images.
Correct.
And you just mentioned a little earlier, maybe I misunderstood, but you're actually able to update it on an hourly basis. How would you do that?
Yes. So with 5 satellites, we would be able to come back to certain spots every hour. That's because our satellites are capable of looking left and right. We call this off nadir angles, and we can go to plus minus 30 degrees using our satellite. So let's say we do one orbit, we can come back and then steer the camera, steer our satellite left or right to cover the same spot again. And this is how we can get hourly revisits.
Okay, but would you do this, let's say, custom made, or would you, I don't know, always need to fly the same pattern? Or can you just, I don't know, at any time reroute the satellite to come to this hourly updates?
We are able to do hourly revisits with a combination of steering the satellite left and right, and also combining different satellites in the constellation. So if one satellite is currently on the other side of the location that it's supposed to look at, but another satellite in the constellation is over that, we can steer the camera left and right to up to 30 degrees plus minus. We cannot change the orbit. We cannot move the satellite to the location. But if the satellite is in the vicinity and it's going to cover an area that is within 30 degrees of the camera's radius, then we can cover this. And that's what we will use then to get hourly revisits.
Okay, so your plan is to shoot up 20 satellites until when? And is this, let's say, the final goal, these 20 satellites, because you don't need more? Or would you really shoot up a lot more satellites for what kind of better services?
We have currently 5 satellites under development, all of which are due for launch next year. The plan is to have 20 satellites by 2028, because we have done an analysis that shows that 20 satellites is what we need currently to cover all of the high priority regions or crisis regions, as you call it, over the Northern Hemisphere. Ideally, to get global coverage in nadir, so the satellite always looking down at one angle, and to have global coverage, we would need 200 satellites. But we are not just a bunch of people coming and launching satellites for the fun of it. We really want to launch satellites based on customer needs. And right now, the customer need is to have eyes over the Northern Hemisphere, over these critical areas in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's why we have come to this magic number of 20.
Okay. So just a few more questions, or maybe one particular one is, if you have these 20 satellites, roughly around 400 kilometers, you said, in height, how much traffic would you expect from other satellites there? Not just now, but maybe as well in the next couple of years and decades. And how would you make sure that there is not any, let's say, traffic jam in that particular area? Because I would assume a lot of service providers would also tackle that that area.
Yeah, it is a question that we ask ourselves as well a lot. I think in the last conference that I went to, somebody had said that there are more than 16,000 objects currently orbiting our planet. And some of them are active, some of them are inactive. The active satellites obviously can be steered a little bit up and down to avoid collision with other objects. This is also how usually
satellites. Is this automated? This is probably automated, right?
There is a database of objects in space, and every mission control needs to have this database. And yeah, I think it is. I'm not sure. I don't work in mission control, right? I'm more on the data side. But my understanding is that there are ways to automatically get a ping. But then we don't want to have an automatic control of the satellite. We're not there yet when it comes to AI for the satellite to steer itself on its own. And that's why mission control is responsible for making sure that there is collision avoidance.
Okay. But we see this is an increasing topic, not just for you, but the whole industry. And we also know that policymakers, at least in Europe, but also from my understanding at the national level in Germany, but all other EU member states need to have some regulations around it, who gets certified to put their satellites up into the orbit or not. And eventually this probably needs to have some global regulation.
Correct. Every satellite that is launched today has a deorbiting plan so that it doesn't stay up forever. Because you do have this domino effect in space. If one particle hits into a satellite, it becomes many different particles that stay there forever until they come to the Earth's atmosphere and burn up. And you want to avoid collision at all rates. So every single satellite that today is launched has a deorbiting plan, which means that we have to ensure that the satellite will burn and will deorbit and will not stay in space forever. This is the basic best practice that is around the entire world. Some countries follow it, some countries don't. But this is also something that has become more and more as a requirement only in, let's say, the last 15 years or so. All the objects that were launched before that might still be up there and might still be causing more damage to other satellites.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on to maybe a little different chapter of our conversation here. It's more about launching and what are the costs tied to this? What are the capacities? You mentioned that you have 5 satellites under development, 15 more are to come. Have you secured your slots already? And with whom are you going to put them into space?
It's a very, very good question. And we at Marble are really looking forward to having European launcher capabilities coming up soon.
ESA Aerospace.
There is ESA Aerospace's rocket factory, Augsburg. There are a few French companies as well. So
are you optimistic that they would be ready? And, you know, because what I remember from ESA Aerospace, at least, I think, you know, they say 28, you want to have your satellites up there in 28 as well. There's probably a lot of, I don't know, other companies also would like to use their capacities. So do you feel comfortable that this could happen with European launches?
It is in high demand. You're absolutely right. And every company that plans to launch is currently trying to secure a spot as quickly as possible. There is also a very high likelihood that SpaceX, for example, would not be providing slots to other companies, might not be available for Europeans anymore. So we as a company, we are aware of this and we have strategies in place to make sure that we get a slot, we secure a slot as early as possible with whoever is available. It would have been nice to have the capacity in Europe already right now. That is also the truth of it, so that we had a functioning ecosystem for developing satellites and also launching it. But I'm excited to see all of these companies in Europe actually being successful, because their success means we can launch our satellites as fast as possible.
Right. And this is, I mean, this is really very interesting, because this is quite a big bet, right? Because you are developing, producing your satellites already without knowing whether your carrier would be available. Of course, the carriers are very optimistic that they can do that. We all know there might be some, let's say, slipping in the schedule as well. So this is quite a challenge that everything, every, you know, pieces really come together. This maybe brings me a little earlier to the question, which I would have had later, about your financing and about your investors, because they would probably want to see some security around that you have actual customers, actual paying customers. What about your customers? Are they comfortable enough already to sign agreements, contracts? Do they already pay maybe for the kind of stuff you're doing? So maybe you can just bring us a little bit into that, which is very fascinating to see if this is actually happening, but how with so much insecurity you're still planning here.
Yeah, I can give you a little bit more detail about this. We just finished a very oversubscribed seed round. We have had a lot of support from venture capitals in Europe, but also private investors. And if you just look at the press releases, you'll see who the leading investors are. So there we have a lot of support. And that's mainly because for our first satellite, we already in 2023, and we founded the company in 2023. So a couple of months after founding the company, we were very lucky to win the German Aerospace or German Space Agency's DLR's small satellite payload competition, which is the Kleinsatelliten Nutzlast Wettbewerb. And that basically secured our launch and our platform development. And then we also were very lucky to get into a European Space Agency INQ program. And we had this fully funded, full equity kind of funding at that stage, which pushed us and gave a lot of support and confidence in the company back then, which helped us secure the first couple of pre-seed investors, but also really helped us in fundraising for the seed round. For the first satellite, because getting fast to space and to the market is very, very important for us, we're launching with SpaceX. And that's why we can very confidently say that we are launching next year in Q1. So it's either Feb or March. So we have already everything secured there. This again gives a lot of confidence to the venture capital firms and the investors. Because
so this is for one satellite or for the first five?
This is for one satellite. Okay. No. This is for one satellite. You must also understand that currently in Europe, there are very few satellite, but also payload providers who can manufacture satellites every week. The manufacturing industry here is just not that established to have satellites popping out every month so that we can launch together.
Right.
So that's why we have a staggered approach. The first satellite, we say four satellites by 2027, potentially the fifth one in 2028, but it'll all be, at least the first one is in the first half of the year. So either Feb or March. The next one would be then in the next quarter, and that's how we go.
Okay, so basically the first satellite you will use SpaceX.
Yes, for the first satellite it is with SpaceX. The next ones I cannot say anything; it's not confirmed as yet. We're trying everything. We're trying to get a slot. It could be with a European micro launcher. It could be with SpaceX. We are really like trying there to get everything confirmed. And then when it comes to customers, just to answer your question, you probably already can imagine that with the 50 centimeter resolution imagery and the current geopolitical situation, there is a lot of demand just for the images. People just want the images because it's very high resolution so that they can use these images when other commercial providers are not providing imagery. Again, as an example, right now in the Middle East, over the Strait of Hormuz, all of the American providers have said they would not provide imagery to non-American customers. And there currently, then Europe has to rely on Airbus or on, let's say, Chinese providers. Mm-hmm. If Marvel had a satellite up there, we would be able to provide the imagery as well. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of demand for the images, and there is a lot of customer traction for the images. So early sales contracts, things like that are already in place. We have a 3 million euro contract with the European Space Agency to provide data. So that is the biggest customer contract that we have already in place. Mm-hmm. And then on the environmental side, which is also where we're active, we also have customer traction for our mangrove deforestation tools, for our coastal vulnerability tools.
And who would be, because this is particular interest from our side here as well, to see how we can use space technologies for improving the conditions here on Earth, obviously. I mean, defense and security is a very important topic, but the, let's say, civilian dual use cases here of very interest as well. Are there paying customers already for this? If you say that you can, of course, you can monitor deforestation, are there private companies paying for these data already?
Yes. This is actually also a very well-established market and where Copernicus has led to the eruption of many analytics and insight providers who provide these kind of solutions.
Yeah, but this is all open data, right? So this is all open data. Taxpayer paid. So this open data, and it's, as you said, it's just on a 10 meter resolution. So the images are not as good as what you would potentially be providing.
Correct.
But you're not taxpayer financed here. So you need to have some remunerations here. So how much or how would you structure such a service? Like a subscription that somebody can have an annual subscription. How much would it be? Would it pay off your costs? So maybe walk us through the business model here and whether they're paying customers already.
Yeah, I'm the data scientist. So, you know, I have been working on all the solutions for so many years.
So you really don't care about how the company is making the money.
Of course you do.
It was just joking. But maybe you can tell us it, just a little bit.
I'm sure I can tell you already here that we are offering our solutions as a software, as a service solution, right? So as a SaaS, we have developed our portal. It's a geospatial portal where our customers or potential customers can come in. They can view all of the satellite data from Marble. And we've also got analytical tools that allow users to just get the information that they need. Like, for example, if a user is really interested in the mangrove deforestation in their particular farm in Vietnam, they can just get the analytics that we offer. It runs on the image that they choose, and then they get the information that they can use in their certification cup. There is a big market there. It's not as big as, let's say, the defense and security market. The budget is currently in the defense and security sector rather than in the environmental sector. So all of these companies that have previously relied on commercial imagery for environmental solutions and for certification are also finding it very tough right now to sustain themselves. There are certification companies that have to do their due diligence. There are carbon credit investors who need to do their due diligence. So this is the market that we address with our solutions, because they don't want to deal with getting the image, downloading it, processing it, and then finally getting the information that they need. They would rather just get the information as quick as possible. And so on our geospatial portal that we've developed already, you could have an annual contract for the customers who really know that they would be using our services regularly, but also we offer pay or as you go services. So if a customer just wants to get the information, what is the water quality in my resort right next to this area? Then they can go and get the information and pay for it as you go. But again, building satellites is very expensive. It's very CapEx heavy. It's also very OpEx heavy. So the solution really is to get these big anchor customer contracts. We're very much B2G right now. We are really trying to get these big government contracts, because this is what we'll pay for developing the 20 satellites that we want to have.
Sure. And this is pretty much probably defense driven right now. But would it also be helpful for key services like navigation, communication? Is that something you would also provide.
Yes, for sure.
But you're probably not providing like any satellite services, right? Because you're really focusing on images.
Correct. So communication is less. Our satellite is mainly for Earth observation. So it's a lot of getting images. You actually touched on a very good point about navigation, and our tools are also really suited for understanding terrain. And that can also help with navigation. And the reason for this is because on our satellites, we have two different telescopes, two different cameras. As if you want to think of them as cameras, then they're two different cameras and they measure in different spectrums. So one of them looks in the visible. So it looks just like you would see it with the eye. So we call it visible to near infrared. You also have near infrared data coming in on the first camera. And then we have shortwave infrared. And shortwave infrared data is very, very good for understanding the terrain and also for understanding man-made versus natural objects. So this is particularly interesting for any kind of tool that requires information about how wet is my area? Can I drive on it? Think about disaster response and disaster management. Imagine there's a flood somewhere and the emergency responders want to know which is the best route for me to take to get to the area that is affected, but they don't want to get stuck in a wet area. And this is why shortwave infrared images that we would provide are very essential for understanding the terrain. And because, again, you don't want to just provide the images to people. If they want the images, they can have the images. So let's say for the government especially, they have a geospatial team. They have people who can work with the images. But sometimes for rapid responders, they just want to know the best or the fastest way to get from point A to point B. And so we have tools that can provide this information on the fly as well. They can say, okay, this is a red and green map. Red are areas you should not drive on. Green are areas that you can drive on. And you can get access to this directly as well from our data.
Okay, so you would not just provide the data, but you would really provide the usable interface for the client as well.
Correct.
Isn't that something where you would, of course, you would be part of a value chain which your customers would be in? So the off-takers of your debtors may not be just the rescue helpers, but might be companies helping to provide these debtors. Is this something where you go into competition with your own clients with that? Or you just cut out the middleman and just make it more affordable for these organizations?
I would like to see it more as meeting the needs of both segments. So if somebody has a solution, but they just need the data, then they come to us because we will have the data. And if somebody just needs a solution, then they can also come to us directly for the solution. So I think here we're catering to both segments of the market. That's why we're a data and analytics company. Users can choose what they need. And the fact is, and I can speak from personal experience, that data is never too few data. It's always we want more data. And that's how I see Marble catering to both segments and not really coming into competition with our clients. If they just want data, they get the data.
All right. So, okay. But I mean, you just gave one example and you probably can, I don't know, there are probably so many different use cases, right? I mean, thinking of agriculture, thinking of, I don't know, traffic jam development, holiday season is starting, weather patterns. So you can really make a lot of predictions out of this if you can be very granular around the images and how things are developing. So you see really developments, not just a static picture of something. Mm-hmm. Energy use, for example.
Yes. But we're a small company, and this is also where we, as a small company, we are 27 people right now, 3 years old. We cannot provide solutions for everything. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning already, we had to take a very strategic decision as to what do we want to offer. We don't want to offer everything. We don't have the capacity for it. And we identified that with our 50 centimeter very high resolution data and with the high revisits, something that we would be very good at is to provide information and to monitor critical assets, to do activity monitoring, to do change detection, because we would have the images for it. And that is a big market segment which we are addressing right now. And there we have for example, we have our own AI-based object detection tool that we have developed from scratch. We have trained it to detect objects, classify objects. And right now we're using commercial data, but also Sentinel-2 data. And eventually when we have Marble data, then we have a lot of training data and also very good data that we can use to provide this information about activity monitoring. So that's one segment that we're actively working on. Then we have the segment with the terrain and traffic ability, because we know that shortwave infrared data is currently not available on most of the other commercial providers. The resolution that we would have is, again, unmatched. So we are catering really, we're working with the strength of our sensors to cater to a market that we know will need our data. And the third aspect, or the third vertical that we're really targeting, is coastal vulnerability. Because we cannot, we have personally, but also in the team, we have a lot of expertise about coastal vulnerability. There's been coastal erosion, water quality checks, deforestation along the coast with mangroves, for example. This is also a sector that needs high revisits, because obviously water quality changes from hour to hour, day to day. So you need to have this revisit from the satellites. And this is a segment, again, that we are actively working on. But we cannot offer solutions for all the verticals.
Sure. And this may come down the road, you have just data companies taking these information and then turning them into products.
Correct.
So this is where you are basically like some sort of a white label product, and then somebody else can use these data. But these, those three areas you just said, the main off-takers, again, would be the government, right? Or are there commercial companies already out there who would be paying for that?
There are commercial companies who would pay for it. It's mainly the government that we are currently targeting, because we control also the satellites, which means that we can task the satellite to get images wherever there is interest. A lot of the commercial companies out there that provide solutions rely on other data. So they become our customers then, right? And this is why, yes, we are targeting the big governmental contracts. We want to make sure that at least the government has reliable European data to make decisions rapidly. We want to just be there to fill the gap. There is a gap, and we're there to fill the gap. So yes, we're targeting the government and trying to get anchor customer contracts with the government. Yes.
Yeah. And at some point, your investors would like to have some traction and maybe do an exit or something like that. Have you thought about an IPO down the road? What is your long-term vision, or is this still too early to say?
I would say it's still too early to say. We are, let the first couple of satellites be launched. And personally, I'm waiting for the data to come. I know that our data is going to be a game changer, because until now, sure, we have the analytical solutions, we have the activity monitoring, we have the water quality or the terrain analysis tools that rely on commercial data, but we don't have marble data. And once the data comes, this is what I'm excited about. And then we can think about everything else after that.
And then on the data, you're probably using a lot of AI already.
Yes.
To process the information, to make extrapolations and these kind of things.
AI is very integral to what we do. It just makes our lives a lot easier, because it's more efficient. Also, on our next couple of satellites, we want to have onboard processing to give the information much faster, because you can do a very quick analysis on board the satellite and then downlink the information. For example, if a ship has been detected somewhere where it's not supposed to be detected, then we can directly downlink the information and give this information to the person who's interested in it. So AI is very integral to everything that we do. But we are also not building AI solutions to have AI control the satellite, for example. We are still in Germany. We still have Satellitendatensicherheitsgesetz and all of this. Everything is very well regulated. And we are actually the only second company in Germany to deal with this Satellitendatensicherheitsgesetz, the data security, satellite data security.
Which will be the other company?
The other one is Airbus for Tandem and TerraSat X.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
So the law is also from 2007, because that was when the first TerraSat X satellite was launched.
All right. Well, slowly coming to an end. What would be the main challenges right now for you guys? I mean, we have journalists listening to us. We have investors listening to this podcast. We have decision makers from politics, but also a lot of entrepreneurs, startup companies, etc. So what are the main challenges right now, and where do you need some support?
The biggest challenge is getting these governmental contracts. This is really where the cycle is very long. And for a startup like ours, this impacts us quite a bit. So this is where I think we say this everywhere on all platforms. I'm also using this platform to say that it would be very, very beneficial for us to have an anchor contract, because this also then shows confidence in us for future investments. We saw this also with the European Space Agency, €3 million contract. The moment we had that contract with them, it resulted in this oversubscribed fundraising round for our seed round, right? So there is this domino effect there as well. You get a contract and you then can accumulate more money to do the work sure. that needs to be done.
Yeah.
So this would be the only thing that I would say is challenging. The rest, you know, we have very smart people in the company. We can solve all of the technical problems and the space problems as long as we can hire people and hire very smart people to do it.
Gopika, all this sounds very, very good. I would have wished to have a lot more time, and I don't want to eat up too much of your time because you have a lot of important things to do right now. I think we probably could have been going on and would have had a lot more questions. But thank you so much for the first overview of what you guys are doing. Hopefully this is not the last conversation we have had. And well, thank you.
Thank you, David. It was really nice talking to you. And we will have more conversations. And I hope everybody is looking forward to the data that comes out next year.
Absolutely.
We are always hiring. That's another thing. So we're always hiring as well. So if somebody finds our journey and our mission interesting, please do check out our website.
All right. Go to Marble Imaging and you will find those job offers. Thank you so much. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Time to surface. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be grateful for a rating or a subscription. This series is produced by DWR Eco in cooperation with Mission Homebound. To go deeper or connect with our guests, visit us at dwr-eco.com or mission-homebound.com.